quietly so that the chap inside held the door so it wouldn't swing open. And then once the guards had gone for the night, the chap whose door was open would get out in the corridor and open the other doors, and then we had a method of picking the lock into the next wing. And from there it was a question of opening a window and slipping out, which, as usual, things didn't go quite as planned, and we were all late. Instead of getting out about 9 at night, it was around 2 before we got out. And also we planned for some workers, foreign workers, to leave some food and a wood pile at the back, which the army had organized for us, and but the food wasn't there, it had gone. So, and we'd been living on a couple of slices of bread and a thin bowl of soup for some weeks, so we were fairly hungry when we got out, and it wasn't a very successful thing. I think we were all recaptured within about 2 or 3 days.
What were the 2 or 3 days like that you were hungry?
Well, pretty miserable, really, because it was about April of 42. The snow had just gone. And the chap I was supposed to go with had his feet were all bitten of fleas, and they'd swollen up, and he couldn't get his boots on, so he stayed, and I went out on my own. But and I didn't make the railway station. We were hoping to make a railway station and get in the train that first night. And I laid up in the bushes. I got down there just about as dawn was getting up, so that day I went and hid in the bushes. But I was very lucky because there was very few, very little undergrowth or anything, woods to hide in. But about 3 guards and a dog must have just laid flat in the ground with a bit of an old branch over me, and 3 dogs and a guard, or 3 guards and a dog with their heads down, talking away, mumbling away, passed by within about 20 feet of me. But it was cold, and it was almost impossible to get food. You're trying to hear a chicken house as you were going along at night. I couldn't get a train the next night, so I guess I got a train that night, and it was one of the last nights I decided I'd have to get some food, but you get close to a chicken house, you know, dogs that bark, and there are no turnips in the field, and it was pretty impossible to get food.
What were you dressed in at the time?
Just an army khaki uniform. And,
so you had to go without being seen.
Oh
completely.
Yes, yeah, you had to.
You didn't speak any other language.
Didn't speak any language. No. So it was pretty tricky. The other, of course, thing as well as wanting to get back, we always felt it confused. It added to the Germans' worries because they had to use a lot of troops looking for people when they were out, and search trains and all this kind of thing, and put probably more people on bridges on guard and this thing. So we felt we were at least occupying some of the Germans.
Were there many escapes from? Which camp are we in?
Warburg, the big big army one. Yes, with that number of people in, of course, and that number of people planning and thinking, there were quite a few.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps after a while this is why they broke up the camp again and put them into smaller units.
What happened when you were captured?
Well, I was recaptured after about, I think on the 3rd day, I felt that I just wasn't making enough time by going along at night and by waiting for trains at night. And I'd been on a train that night, and I thought, well, I'll stay and I'll try and ride the train by day. I was trying to get into Holland. Just after daybreak, I was on this one train and standing on the siding, and another one was going by starting to move out, and I ran around the corner to try and get it, and I walked around the corner. There was a group of French workers with a German guard, and of course I stepped out in my old British uniform in front of him, and he raised his rifle and had it aimed at me, so I put up my hands, and that was the end of my escape.
Were you punished in any way?
Well, I was in cells there for a while, and fortunately I gave my name and my rank as being Navy. And then they phoned back to the camp and said, well, we hadn't lost anybody like that. There's an army guy who'd gone out. So, I was kept in cells separately from the rest of the camp, and I never got back into the camp. They collected us up And we were all sent back to Stalag-Luft 3 at Sagan after that, joined the Air Force again. Mm-hmm. Not the escapers.
Yeah. What was Stalag-Luft 3 like? It was a very large camp?
Originally they had about three. I was sent back to the East Camp, which was an old part of the camp, and at that time they'd just opened up what they called the North Camp, which was a bigger one. And again, that was in sand, and it was in Silesia. Sand and pine trees, and I guess they thought this will put an end to the tunneling in this one.
Yeah.
And from there, they sort of lose track of time.
Were conditions better at, at some point you were at Shubin?
Yes, conditions were better there. Yes, I think of 42, I think it was about the fall of 42. This was April, and I escaped, and from April I was sent to the Stalag-Luft 3 on the East Camp, and then they walked in there in the fall and called out another list of names again, and I was on that, and we were moved to Shubin in Poland again, which was a pretty cold, desolate camp that had old brick buildings which we were quartered in, and that was a pretty miserable winter there, and it was a little cold, kind of, that'd be the winter of 43.
Little food?
And
more food by this time?
Well, the Red Cross parcels were coming through occasionally by this time, yes. Food had improved quite a bit.
And how about the treatment by the guards?
Treatment, again, very strict and firm, but not too bad. We had a few, you know, problems. I remember one night, one of the chaps, the group were playing cards or something and sitting in a circle. And a guard walked in, and he thought they must have been planning an escape or something, and drew his revolver and was swinging it around. One chap was smoking, he took his cigarette and jammed his cigarette down on the guard's hand of the revolver. Fortunately, when he pulled the trigger, nobody was hurt, but I think this chap was gone. He was actually the chap that was supposed to escape with me. And he sleeps and everything, but a few days later he walked up to the wire in broad daylight and tried to walk over it, and the guard the other side just shot him, and they wouldn't let us get him out of the wire, and he was pretty well dead by the time they did get him out of the wire. He died there. On the whole, the guards got 10 days leave if they shot somebody, so there was a bit of a a desire to go home before, yeah. I guess, every now and again, so if they had the chance, they would use it.
And how long were you in Shubin for? Short time?
It's hard to, I think it was, I got back, I think the Great Escape in Stalag-Luft 3 was about March of 44.
And you were back
and
in the spring of 44.
And I got back just a bit before that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
When I went into the North Camp, when I came back, this is in the North Camp, which is quite a lot bigger camp.
What do you remember about the preparation and organization for the Great Escape?
Well, it was done tremendously well. Of course, a lot of the guys involved in it had 4 years of escape experience and organization experience, and they'd also had a larger number of people who had come in from other occupations to draw their experience from. We had mining people, and we had people who'd been tailors, and people who'd been artists who could do forgery and all those kind of things. And the organization was set up that they could use the capabilities of these people. Well, it was an excellent organization.
How many people would have been involved?
Well, they were trying to get out, they were hoping to get out about 300, but on the organization, with your diggers and your lookouts and your, I would think probably almost 200 people involved in the whole organization.
And what were you doing?
Well, I was on the, wasn't in the hut where it was being dug, but I was on a, we had a radio in the camp, and I was, on the security side of the radio at that time, so I wasn't involved in the Great Escape. I was involved on the on the radio security.
But your name was
the,
on the list, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. I was actually going out with a Norwegian, and and I learned to speak a bit of Norwegian so that we could get passed as Norwegians, we hoped. But another Norwegian was shot down just before the tunnel was due to break. And he, of course, was very good with, spoke excellent Norwegian. And I thought that the two of they were friends, and I thought they'd known each other before in the Air Force, and I thought, well, I'd be better to step down and let this other chap go. Other chances would be greater if they went out together. And unfortunately, they were both shot. The two other Norwegians, good friends, got back. They got into a ship, and they got back to, I think three got back.
Three.
But a few years later, I met this one of the Norwegians in Oslo, and he said they were very lucky because they got into the ship, Swedish ship on the Baltic, and the Germans had searched it, and the Germans actually put his hand on this guy's face and didn't realize that there's a face. He got back.
What was the mood in the camp? How many people knew about the escape?
I
than most everyone.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, I think practically the whole camp. And it shows you the spirit of cooperation when you think that the whole thing was kept very secret and very quiet from the Germans. They had no idea, I don't think, that the big tunnel was going on.
It must have improved morale.
Oh, it
knowing
did.
That
yes.
There was
yes.
such a...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's such a, 300 people hoping to get out.
Yeah.
And everybody realized that 300 wouldn't get back to UK, but it would cause a lot of unnecessary work for the Germans trying to round them up. And at a time when they didn't need it, but their armies could have been used elsewhere. It was very demoralizing when they, in a way, when they announced that they had shot the 50.
Yeah.
And then, of course, after that, they declared zones, death zones, and said you'll be shot if you're found in any of these zones. And they wouldn't tell us where the zones were. So from there on, they meant business when anybody tried to escape. I guess with the invasion coming up and this kind of thing, they were using, wanted all the manpower they could get for both fronts, the East Front and the West Front. And they were taking a kicking on the East Front at that time too. So they really didn't want to expand the manpower in searching for prisoners.
Was treatment for the prisoners after the escape a lot harsher?
It was for a while, yes. And then, of course,
they slacked off.
Slacked
yeah.
off, as usual, yes. And, of course, at that time, shortly after that, the invasion took place. And so many of the Germans realized at that stage that they were going to be beaten. And their attitude changed considerably.
How much did you know about what was going on with the invasion?
We had, on this radio thing, we got the BBC News every night. And we used to copy it down. There'd be this little RN chap working the dials and another chap copying it down. And I was stood behind them getting ready to put stuff away if any of the guards came along. And then we'd pass the news the next morning from block to block. And the chap would go around and pass the news each morning. So we were pretty well up to date on everything that's happened.
You'd lost your desire to escape by this time? Did you thought the war was going to end soon?
Well, yeah. By a lot of us, of course, when the invasion came, thought, well, we're going to be home by the end of '44. So, I think it did make people think very much more about escaping after they announced these death zones, because unless you were a fluent German speaker and you had good clothes, good maps, and good passes, and this kind of thing, your chances of getting back were pretty slim.
Was there ever a large effort to work on the... I think there was one tunnel left, wasn't there, that had been started that hadn't been found?
Yes, they were using that one, as I remember, for filling in from the old one. And I think they found that other one, too, after that. They made a tremendous effort, as I remember. Yeah.
Did you?
But there was quite a reaction the first day when they found out that the guys had escaped. They brought in men galore with machine guns,
yes,
and dogs and all the rest of it.
Right. The commandant was he court-martialed?
He was certainly moved. I imagine he. I've forgotten now, but he was either court-martialed or moved.
Did you stay in Stalag Luft III, or?
We did until I did until the January 45 or early February 45. We could hear the old Russian guns coming, and they were getting closer, and they marched us out in one night in the dead of winter. Snow. Some of the chaps had built sleighs and this kind of thing, and we at that stage, as I remember, had a few more parcels come in, so we were fairly well fed and fairly well equipped the first part of it. But the march, that march is very hard because we went out, there must have been a foot or so of snow, and it was a question of marching in front of the Russians. We were allowed a 10-minute stop every hour or something, and they seemed to go on for days, day and night, so I had to keep ahead. And occasionally we got into barns and this kind of thing, but we eventually got to too far east, we're in an old Marine camp, and we'd been there, I would think, a month. I've forgotten the town, it was just south of quite, and we found when we got there the place was stocked with Red Cross parcels, so we had a good month's feed, and then the British crossed the Rhine, and we were marched back east again. But by this time we had made pack boards and stacked up as much food as we could. And I think I forgot that would be I guess early April, and we were lived out in the fields from then until we were released south of Lubeck in March, in May the 4th, just before VE Day in 45.
Were you in a camp at this?
No, we'd been out
still,
still out in the fields marching. Yeah. Had some pretty sad, sad tale there too, because at that stage, our fighters, the British fighters, or Allied fighters, were just all over Germany, and of course they had no air opposition. And they'd see a column marching, and we were attacked a couple of times. Some of the guys who'd been all through the war for 5 years as a POW were killed, which is a bit sad at that stage.
There was no way of marking yourselves? So.
No, really. I guess they just saw columns, and
they would be so hot.
Came down, yeah. Don't remember ever seeing any way of seeing anything marked.
What do you remember about the end of the war? When did you first know about it?
Well, we heard, even when we were marching, we kept a little radio, and then the guards would tell us stuff too, which they lost, I think it was about the 21st of April, about the time Hitler committed suicide, and they lost contact with Berlin, and their communications were messed up completely. So really they knew full well, the guards that were with us, that they were coming close to the end of the war. But they still, we used to sneak out in the summer, still pretty bitter. We used to sneak, some of the guys sneak out at night and try and find food and turnips and this kind of thing. But towards the end of the march, we'd run out of food again, and people would sneak out and try and steal stuff and then sneak back in. But the guards had said if, when we on our last march, if anybody tries to escape, we're going to shoot the lot of you. Okay. So we just had a general agreement amongst us that the war was so close to an end that it would just jeopardize the people who were left behind if you tried to escape. So, but on a couple of nights, the guards did shoot guys coming back in and killed them. And we got their names, and of course the British Army took care of them once they overrun us. But the night just before the British Army moved in, most of the guards disappeared. They threw their rifles in a pond, I guess, or a river, and took off their badges and silently crept away. I think there was They just left a few sentries around the field by the time the British arrived.
What happened after?
Typical British arrival. We heard there was a tank not far down the road, and most of the guards had disappeared, and you could hear the firing going on, this kind of thing. So one of the chaps said, "Let's get down and at least get a tank in amongst us." And the tank guys were having their tea, and they said, "We're going to finish our tea, and then we'll be along." After the when they had to relieve us, we were not, you know, living out in the fields, not very good. Didn't look very good, really. Their old scruffy uniforms and shoes that were worn out, this kind of thing. So the British colonel said, "Oh, we're going to have to check all you guys out to see who you are. It'll take a couple of weeks." Huh. And of course, the camp just disappeared, and the Tommies helped us like crazy. They said, "Oh, put you in a truck. There's supposed to be only one-way traffic coming up, but the Tommies had find trucks for us," and this kind of thing got us out. And I was with a group. We got back south of Holland just before armistice, and one of the chaps, Air Force chap, said, "Oh, one of his guys he knew had been moved to Air Ministry, and he got a telephone line through the Air Ministry and some form of communication." So not really how he did it, but the guy said, "Oh, I'll have a squadron of Lancs for you guys arriving at the airfield in the morning. Just stay there." So in the morning, the old Lancs started pouring in, and by that time we'd organized ourselves that the early prisoners of war got priority, and they went home first. So I got back on the VE day, the day war ended, the arms officially. Got back to an Air Force airfield and got deloused and given a new some new army clothes.
What did you do after following that? Did you have leave?
Yes, after that I got some, they gave us leave, and I didn't get permission to come back to Canada, but I did get back to a new chap up at the Admiralty and said, "You know, I really couldn't, we got 3 months leave, and I couldn't fill in 3 months leave in UK, could I go back to Canada?" And he said, "Well, not really, because that is a foreign country, and you weren't allowed to leave in a foreign country during wartime." But he gave me a letter that got me across to Ireland and said, "Then, you know, go and catch a ride on a Corvette, they'll give you a ride home." And this would be sometime in June, as I remember, so he told me to be back by the 1st of August. I got a hitchhike way back on a Corvette to Newfie and Halifax.
And you decided to stay in?
Yes, I went back to the RN. I was back by the 1st of August, various means. And we did a fighter refresher course, went on and flew Spitfires. And they moved us around the country and gave us, we flew all the aircraft that were in operations at that time, and then I went back on the Spitfires for did a fighter refresher course, and then the Jap War ended, and I was down at St. Marin, and I'd had a 7-year short service commission when I joined up, so that was up in November '45, and about January they suddenly realized I was still in the RN, so I was called to Admiralty and asked if I'd like to stay on or go home, and I said, "Oh, I think I'll go home," and then they said, "Oh, well, how would you like to transfer to the Canadian Navy? They're just forming a fleet arm." And they just transferred me over, and I walked down the Hill Street where they had the Niobe, I think it was, and joined the Canadian Navy.